Hello there. Today is Thursday, December 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump and congressional Republicans celebrate a big win for their agenda.
On this vote, the yeas are 224 and the nays are 201. The motion is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
The chorus of Republicans calling for an end to the Russia investigation is growing. South Africa's new leader talks about a way forward. And someone with millions of Twitter followers accidentally gives out his phone number. It's all on today's International Edition. Republicans are celebrating the passage of a U.S. tax overhaul on Wednesday, the first major legislative victory of Donald Trump's presidency.
The heart of our bill is a tremendous amount of relief for the middle class, including a doubling of the child tax credit and a nearly doubling of the standard deduction. That's going to be tremendous for people. They're going to start seeing the results in February. This bill means more take-home pay. It will be an incredible Christmas gift for hardworking Americans.
House Speaker Paul Ryan has called it the most sweeping pro-growth overhaul of our tax code in a generation. Democrats, though, slammed the legislation as mortgaging America's future at home and abroad in order to pad the pockets of the wealthy. By contrast, Republicans jubilantly argued the tax cuts will rev up the economy and make American businesses more competitive at home and abroad. The legislation also partially repeals former President Barack Obama's signature health care law, eliminating the requirement that Americans purchase health care insurance. As a result, some 13 million fewer Americans would be insured over the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Some Democrats noted that the president, a real estate mogul, could benefit greatly from certain provisions in the bill. Trump has maintained that the change in tax law would cost him money. VOA's Catherine Gibson has more on Wednesday's historic vote.
The yeas are 227 and the nays are 203.
A vote to bring America back.
The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
The whole world is watching what we're doing here today. Countries around the globe are getting the message loud and clear that America is committed to leading in the 21st century.
That's how congressional Republicans and President Trump describe passage of the bill promised more than 10 months ago as part of an ambitious first-year agenda.
It will be a big, big cut. At the same time, we will provide massive tax relief for the middle class.
Businesses will benefit from tax cuts, Republicans say, encouraging growth here in the United States.
If you're an American like those of us here, that are tired of seeing jobs shipped overseas because America had the highest corporate tax rate in the industrialized world and we couldn't compete anymore, this is an historic day for you to finally be able to see those jobs come back to America.
But the economic consequences of the bill are still up for debate, some analysts say.
There are no guarantees. There's no ties. There's no requirements set in a tax bill that tells these companies that the money has to be used to pay their employees more, to hire more personnel, to incentivize their staff with more benefits or for research and development or equipment that would effectively help in the economy.
And in an opinion poll conducted just before the final version was released, almost half of Americans said they disapproved of the bill, a problem lawmakers say will be solved when Americans start to see the impact on their paychecks.
I think when people figure out just how good this tax bill is, they're going to be supportive of us going forward. It's a big win for middle-class Americans.
But numbers from the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center show a different reality, with 86 million middle-class households seeing a tax increase. Those numbers frustrating Hill Democrats, who all voted against the bill.
Republicans will rue the day they pass this bill, and the American people we'll never let him forget it. What has been sold as a job creator and wage booster will, of course, do little of either.
And Democrats said the rest of the world would be the ones to see the benefits.
It's a job killer that will help big corporations move jobs overseas. It will create them over in China and Mexico and Malaysia.
But for now, Republicans are savoring a tough victory.
This is one of the most important pieces of legislation that Congress has passed in decades to help the American worker, to help grow the American economy. This is profound change.
And hoping that change will help as they head into a tough midterm election year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Well, the newly elected head of South Africa's ruling ANC party Thursday called for unity and an end to invested interests in politics in his maiden speech to members of his African National Congress party as they ended a five-day conference near Johannesburg. The administration of President Jacob Zuma has been plagued by corruption scandals, a slower economy, and anger. Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, 65-year-old trade union leader and businessman, told ANC members he aims to stamp out corruption and speed up economic transformation.
The policies that we have adopted are going to be the levers that we are going to use to speed up radical economic transformation. This conference, with unanimous agreement, has resolved that the expropriation of land without compensation should be amongst the mechanisms available to government to give effect to land reform and redistribution. It has also been resolved that in implementing this decision, we must ensure that we do not undermine the economy, the agricultural production, and food security in our country. That is what is important.
Well, VOA's Victor Beatty asks Council on Foreign Relations Senior Fellow for Africa Studies John Campbell if Ramaphosa's goals are a bit too ambitious for a party that's fairly tarnished by scandal.
Yes. However, both of those points that Ramaphosa is making have been around for a long time. Everybody in South Africa is opposed to corruption. Corruption has become a kind of symbol of the Zuma administration, and the ANC is badly tarred by it. Economic transformation, that reflects a fundamental reality. The rate of social and economic change in South Africa since the end of apartheid has been glacial. The gap between the wealth of the white minority and everybody else is in fact greater now than it was in 1994. But the issues are difficult, and that is because the Constitution, of which Ramaphosa was one of the architects, guarantees the right of private property so that wholesale expropriation is not possible.
This presents a big problem for the black majority?
It does. Now, the ANC, in effect, has been a kind of center-right party. It's not been radical at all. Its economic policies have essentially reflected the Washington consensus of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Essentially, the ANC black elite wanted to join the white elite, not destroy it. And so, in effect, it has not been a radical party. It is difficult to imagine that it will become a radical party under Cyril Ramaphosa, who is one of the richest men in South Africa.
So how will he speed up expropriation? Will he try to amend the Constitution?
I doubt it. The Constitution is pretty sacrosanct. It's sacrosanct because it's a symbol of the end of apartheid and the liberation of the black majority. Essentially, if you're going to advance land reform in South Africa, it essentially is within the context of a willing seller, willing buyer. And what that would require is the appropriation of more money for the purchase of land. There's an issue here. The issue is that the country is rapidly becoming urbanized. More than half the population now lives in cities. So that land reform as an issue it's not archaic yet, but it's becoming archaic. Further, Ramaphosa and his wing of the ANC is based in cities, not in the countryside. And in that sense, he is different from his principal political rival, Dlamini Zuma, the ex-wife of Jacob Zuma. Her power base has been the countryside.
His victory was pretty narrow over her. Does that show a party that's divided going into the election in 2019 that could spell trouble for him?
It does indeed. The party is badly divided. If you like, the Zuma side of the party, including the current president and his ex-wife, essentially talks about addressing the poverty of the majority through redistribution. In other words, a transfer of wealth from the white minority to the black majority. Ramaphosa's wing of the party talks about addressing poverty essentially through growing the economy, making the entire pie much larger, as opposed to redistribution.
Is it fair to say that what happens in South Africa will really have ripple effects throughout the continent of Africa? It is one of the biggest economies.
In fact, it is the biggest economy, and it is by far the largest modern economy on the African continent. Yes, indeed. A successful South Africa with an economy that follows the broad outlines of a liberal market economy as advocated by the Washington Consensus becomes a very powerful example for the rest of the continent.
It's Council on Foreign Relations Senior Fellow for Africa Studies John Campbell speaking to VOA's Victor Beatty. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A lawsuit claims Somalis on a U.S. deportation flight were shackled for days, or Somalis, I should say. The British Prime Minister's deputy resigns. Turks will be able to apply for U.S. visas again in 2019. And as Spain braces for Catalonia elections, pro-unity campaigners fear economic catastrophe. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Senator Mark Warner has spoken out about what he calls a growing chorus of irresponsible and reckless voices calling for an end to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of ties between Russia and the Trump campaign for the U.S. presidency, saying such a move has the potential to provoke a constitutional crisis. Warner, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, expressed concern that critics of the investigation seem to be growing in stridency and volume and seemed coordinated in recent weeks.
Firing Mr. Mueller or any other of the top brass involved in this investigation would not only call into question this administration's commitment to the truth, but also to our most basic concept, rule of law.
Trump has regularly disparaged Mueller and congressional investigations of his campaign's links to Russia, and Republicans have increasingly criticized the Mueller probe as biased against Trump. Mueller dismissed one key FBI investigator from the probe when it discovered he'd exchanged negative comments about Trump in emails with another FBI official connected to the probe. Well, joining us now to discuss and also talk about his new book, which seemed to predict the rise of Donald Trump and many similarities to what's happening, is former Pentagon reporter and author of the new political thriller novel, High Hand, James Rosen. Thanks for being with us. So before we get to the book, what do you make of all this regarding attempts to discredit the special counsel?
They're certainly trying to discredit Mueller. I mean, President Trump has been trying to discredit Mueller ever since the day he was appointed, you know, saying there's no there's no... You know, the whole thing is a hoax. The big question is whether, as has been rumored on Capitol Hill days and perhaps weeks, whether President Trump might fire Special Counsel Mueller. My personal opinion is that although President Trump has done some things that were surprising and politically harmful to him, starting with firing Mr. Comey as FBI director, I think that would be a bridge too far. I would be surprised if he fired Mueller, and I think if he did fire Mueller, that would be finally something that Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McConnell and other top Republicans in Congress might have trouble stomaching, because I think it would potentially rebound against them in the 2018 elections. In terms of where the investigation is going, I think Mueller has established a clear pattern of working his way up from lower Trump aides, both during the campaign and since, from lower Trump aides, working up the food chain. My personal opinion is that he's got President Trump in his sights. I think, you know, the indictment of General Flynn, and he's the indictment of Paul Manafort, who for, I think, 7 months was Trump's campaign manager. These are not the folks that Mueller is ultimately.
He's after something, or he's looking for truth?
You know, he's looking for truth, but truth is in the eye of the beholder. I think, you know, famously what we learned in Watergate is the cover-up is worse than the crime. And I think where President Trump and his top aides are most vulnerable is possibly, I have to say that, as a hedge, is maybe not so much the original alleged collusion, but their possible cover-up of their actions during the campaign after the election. I will say this. I mean, one of the big mysteries now in Washington is if there really was no collusion, and if there's no there, and it's all a hoax, which is what President Trump has consistently said, why have so many of his top aides been so secretive about everything? Why have they changed their stories so often? It doesn't make sense, and it raises suspicions that there is more there.
You not only are a former national security journalist, but you're also an author of spy novels, and you've got a new political thriller, High Hand, which is fascinating for many reasons, including how it seems to predict the rise of Donald Trump and his actual ties to Russia long before he became president. How'd you do that? Are you also psychic, or was this, how did that?
Well, this was an unusual endeavor. I have two co-authors, Dr. Curtis Harris, who's one of the leading cancer scientists in the world, and James Ellenberger, who's a retired, very senior official of the AFL-CIO, the country's largest labor federation. We all brought distinct backgrounds, but all of us have traveled widely around the world, have worked around the world, and have a number of contacts, both, you know, current and former, both within the United States government, but also folks who've worked for other governments. And, you know, it just didn't seem that preposterous to us that you could have a presidential candidate with a secret past, with secret ties to another foreign government. You know, we got lucky, quote unquote, in that we made our candidate a billionaire Republican. He's from California. He's not from New York like President Trump. And we decided that he had secret ties to the Kremlin. And that really came from my specific background. I'm a former Moscow correspondent. I've made, since I covered the fall of the Soviet Union, and then I made a number of return trips since then. You know, when we started writing the book, Russia had kind of fallen away from the headlines. Americans weren't paying much attention to it. But I've always been fascinated by Russia, and I've always felt that it's a, you know, even though it was, you could say, a superpower in decline, it's a very powerful country, very ambitious country. President Putin is extremely resentful that the United States, of the two Cold War superpowers, emerged supreme, and he wanted to get back Russian dominance on the world stage. And so there's a certain amount of luck and experience, I think, rolled into it.
What else can you tell people about the book? And
it's my first novel, and I hope to write at least one other novel. It's pretty sophisticated as far as spy novels go. It takes place around the world. It has a number of international foreign characters. It's got a quite complex plot, and it also contains a lot of American and world history. A good deal of it takes place in Moscow. And I think if people want to understand what's going on with Russia today, this would be a pretty vivid entree.
All right. Former Pentagon reporter and author of the new political thriller, High Hand, James Rosen, thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues as we turn now to the latest social media news. And for that, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, we have talked all about social media's influence on all kinds of attitudes and behaviors, and today we have another study that talks about that, and it's actually quite interesting. It's from Ball State University in Indiana, and it says that the more time people spend on social media, the more likely that they are to be afraid of crime.
Really?
The study asked about 900 young adults about their social media use and how they felt about crime, and they found that social media caused people who even haven't been the victim of a crime to be more afraid of becoming a victim or criminal activity generally.
Hmm.
Now, we've talked before about social media and how it can cause things like FOMO, fear of missing out.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you see all your friends' pictures on
right,
their vacations
exactly.
and you
mm-hmm.
feel bad or depressed about yourself. That's something that's been studied extensively.
Right. Yes.
But this is the first time I've seen something about crime on
uh-huh.
social media. And it could have big implications on security and how social media might be used to influence attitudes and opinions. For instance, could this fear of crime spurred by social media make people more aware of criminal activity, thus keeping them safer? Or could it make them more hostile and maybe fight more or have stronger prejudices against people? Not quite clear, but that's the interesting thing about these studies. It sets this baseline. It gives researchers something to digest and look into and examine the further implications of social media.
Fascinating.
Yeah, definitely is.
All right. Well, anything else?
Yes. A fun story about Elon Musk, one of
okay.
the most accomplished business moguls and inventors in modern
yes,
time.
For
of course,
sure.
CEO of the private space exploration company SpaceX, the CEO of electric car company Tesla, multi-billionaire, very well known. Well, on Wednesday, Elon Musk showed that despite all those accomplishments, Lori, he can still make the same social media mistakes that everybody else makes.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, it is a much higher scale and higher profile because of who he is. He sent out a tweet on Wednesday that was supposed to be a direct message, and in doing so, he accidentally revealed his cell phone number to his 17 million Twitter followers. Now, the tweet that was supposed to be a message went out and said, "Do you have a sec to talk? My cell is," and then lists the cell number, which we are not going to give out on air because, for his sake, but also you probably won't get through anyway because
there's
a lot of people on social media have tried to do. They've tried to call Elon Musk. They've gotten to the voicemail.
I assume he's changed the number now.
The voicemail box is full. Well, I assume he's changed the number already. If he hasn't already,
uh-huh.
he's going to want to change that. But people were able to get through to the voicemail box.
Really?
I don't think he'll be checking those voicemails.
kind
of interesting that he was trying to reach out to a man named John Carmack, who is a top executive at Facebook, who previously worked with Elon Musk on some of his business ventures.
Okay.
So kind of interesting, people wondering if he was trying to recruit him because John Carmack has been working with the Oculus virtual reality program.
Right.
John Carmack put out a statement saying, "No, we're just friends. He was trying to get my contact information so we could catch up." But kind of interesting, too, that he was using Twitter direct messaging to contact a Facebook executive. So something else he might want to rethink in the future. But if you have Elon Musk's cell phone number and are trying to reach him and can't get through, more likely than not, he has changed it. So you might want to contact him and get an update. But if you are like me and don't know Elon Musk and see that cell phone number, I wouldn't even bother trying to call because at this point, I think it's been disconnected.
I would imagine. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, music hath charms, as the saying goes, and it does have power to make us happy, sad, or even ignite social change. But it also has healing powers, and researchers want to know how that works. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
The soothing sounds of a violin and the graceful movements of dancers can help take people's minds off painful hospital procedures like chemotherapy.
It reduces anxiety, and it can also help decrease the amount of medication that a patient needs.
Researchers at the National Institutes of Health are studying how exactly music affects the body.
If we can study the arts in the same way that science studies medications and other therapeutics, I think we will be doing so much good for cura personalis or care of the whole person.
This here opera singer Renee Fleming is part of the study, working with researcher David Jangraw.
If you really want to engage certain parts of the brain, you have to get the person to actually sing along or play an instrument or become part of the music-making process.
Fleming underwent brain scans while speaking, singing, or imagining a piece of music. What researchers discovered is that processing music is an incredibly complex process, and imagining music may be even more complicated. And that music may be a pathway to engage parts of the brain and speed up the healing process.
What neuroscience can do is help us understand which parts of the brain are active when we're making music. And if we find out that that part of the brain is also affected by a disease or a disorder or an injury, now we know that music can be a part of the solution to helping that part of the brain.
But beyond healing, learning or playing music keeps the brain sharp, improves kids' language skills, and helps improve grades. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Patrick Dea. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has announced an additional $130 million in emergency food assistance to Yemen through the U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID. This brings the total U.S. contribution in humanitarian aid for the people of Yemen to nearly $768 million since October 2016. The deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen is a matter of grave concern for the United States. More than 22 million Yemenis are in dire need of assistance, with more than 8 million on the brink of famine, according to the United Nations. The country has been brought to this state because of the conflict that began in 2015, when Houthi rebels, supported by Iran, seized the capital of Sana'a and drove the internationally recognized government into exile. At the request of the Yemeni government, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia began airstrikes on rebel positions to stop their expansion. Not enough critically needed supplies are reaching the suffering Yemeni people. The United States has repeatedly called on the Saudi-led military coalition to facilitate the free flow of humanitarian aid and commercial imports to all of Yemen's ports and through Sana'a Airport. USAID Administrator Mark Green noted that the small amount of goods that Saudi Arabia has let into Yemen so far is not nearly enough to address the tremendous need. In addition to urging Saudi Arabia to allow humanitarian aid to reach all points where it is needed, the White House has also called on the Iranian-backed Houthi militias to allow food, medicine, and fuel to be distributed throughout the areas they control, rather than diverted to sustain their military campaign against the Yemeni people. The United States urges all parties to the conflict in Yemen to immediately cease hostilities, re-energize political talks, and end the suffering of the Yemeni people. As White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said in a press statement earlier this month, the United States continues to believe that the devastating conflict in Yemen and the suffering it causes must be brought to an end through political negotiations, in accordance with relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions. Successful political negotiations are necessary to ensure that Yemen can flourish, free of the malign influence of Iranian-backed militias operating outside the structures of the state.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.